My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Alifair Burke. Alifair, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I've spoken to you, a half a dozen times now?
Eight books, maybe eight interviews.
Yeah, maybe. I think I missed a couple.
Okay.
But yeah, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. The title of your latest book is Never Tell. Your first name is spelled A-L-A-F-A-I-R, Burke, B-U-R-K-E, and it's published by Harper. We have Ellie Hatcher in this book. Ellie is a New York City homicide detective. Tell us about Ellie a little bit.
This is the fourth book with Ellie Hatcher, and each one she finds a little bit more maturity, I think. In the first book, she started out young and was kind of handled a homicide case for the very first time, and now she's more in a rhythm with a partner that she really trusts, J.J. Rogan, her personal life. She's starting to have to be a little bit more of a grown-up there, too. But this particular case, since it involves a case where it's unclear if it's murder or suicide, really taps into her own personal issues because she's very much haunted still by the death of her own father, where it was unclear whether he had killed himself or whether, as she had believed for many years, whether he was the victim of homicide. So she's kind of coming to grips with those issues still and trying not to let it taint her view of the case she's been given.
Well, with more or less success as the case goes
on. Yeah, her head is getting a little bit straighter with each book. So.
Well, that's funny because I read this
book.
If she ever
gets it straight on, it might not be as interesting.
That's interesting. As I was reading this book, I said, she's a kvetch. She's easily irritated. She has an ongoing relationship with Max Donovan, who's an assistant district attorney in Manhattan. And she puts him through changes. He had the temerity to think that he understood their relationship, and it turned out that he didn't.
Right.
Duh.
And, who hasn't had that happen?
Yeah, none of us has had that happen. So between one thing and another, she's in an emotional state when this thing happens. And the crime scene that she comes in at the beginning is a chaotic crime scene. And then there's a little girl in a bathtub who appears to have killed herself. You want to tell us a little about that?
Uh-huh. So Julia Whitmire, her death is the one that kind of kicks the book off. And she's a very privileged kid in a lot of ways, in the moneyed ways. Her dad is a record producer, and her mother is the wife of a record producer.
That's right,
and, yeah. You know, they've reached a stage in their life where they're spending more time in East Hampton than in the city, and they kind of choose to believe that their kids can fend for themselves, you know, because they can call the nannies and call the drivers if they need anything. But Julia is really raising herself.
They have cell phones and email. They can call you whenever they like, right?
Yeah. And
except they don't.
It's funny, people who... I grew up in Kansas and I lived for 10 years here in Portland. And, you know, readers from those places will say to me, like, how realistic that, you know, why isn't anyone calling the state on these parents? And it's not until I moved to New York that you really understand what real wealth looks like and what it can do to people. And the idea of a kid who really is living on her own already at 16 is not an uncommon thing to encounter there.
Well, I got a hot flash for you because I did not grow up in a wealthy family, and we were a two-job family. My mom worked and my stepfather worked, and that was the way it had to be. So when I got home from school, I was home from school alone.
Right.
And it's as simple as that. And, kids, I was latchkey kid was the term that they used to use for that. And I thought that was great because I read a lot when I was a kid, but I was not... And tempted by some of the things that kids can be tempted by nowadays. And in fact, one of the things that Julia likes to do is mix with people, quote unquote, beneath her station, get a little more, interesting perspective on life. She's a bit of a independent spirit and a character.
Yeah. I mean, the book really is about her friendship with Ramona Langston. And these two girls go to the same prep school, and compared to the rest of the world, they would both seem pretty wealthy, but there's wealthy and then there's really wealthy. And Julia is the latter. And she's sort of the queen bee in the relationship. And Ramona has almost a sort of obsession with her, you know, kind of tags along in her shadow. But what the two of them have in common is they kind of want to peer out, sometimes recklessly and dangerously, from this little bubble of a world that they occupy. And so they wind up with some unusual friendships. One of my favorite characters in the book is a homeless teenager named Casey Hines. And they also wind up, particularly Julia, winds up doing some very reckless things. Some of the stories that are in the book, just anecdotally, about things that she's done that might have put her at risk are all things that I've heard to be true about actual supposedly very stable, privileged kids.
I went to high school in the 50s, graduated in 1960, and it was pretty straight-laced in those days. I mean, there were always kids who didn't conform and who colored outside right. the lines. But compared to what's going on today, we were like church mice. It was ridiculous. Right. Kids do things nowadays sexually and
yes.
and socially that we would right. never have thought of in those
yeah,
days.
Yeah, I mean, sort of the mainstreaming of the kind of the sex industry culture is pretty amazing, where half of the starlets that you could name that are famous for doing nothing, they're not famous for nothing. They're famous for sex tapes.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like that's the launching pad now, the platform from which people become famous. And I think that has seeped its way into an entire generation of girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paris Hilton and the Kardashians are the two that come to mind
yep.
immediately. But
mm-hmm.
they don't really have careers in any sense except as celebrities.
Right,
yeah.
right. Although then they become, I think they both have fashion companies now, and they both are billionaires.
Yeah, well, they started out millionaires,
yeah.
so it's pretty easy to
do. Not exactly self-made.
Exactly, yeah. There's also another thing going on. One of the first things that happens in the book is a woman blogging mm-hmm. about an unfortunate youth mm-hmm. where she was sexually molested. And has been festering in her whole life. And then as an adult, she finally feels not just the necessity, but the ability mm-hmm. to talk about it online. Can you tell us about that? I know I don't want to tread too heavily on the plot here.
Yeah, I don't think it's probably too much of a spoiler to tell readers that when they start the book, there's really two parallel stories going on. One having to do with the death of Julia Whitmire at her townhouse, and then one is this blogger who's being threatened, and we don't really know by whom. And eventually those two come together in sort of what I hope are surprising ways. But so the idea of somebody who finds release through writing has always been something appealing to me, because I find myself, you know, sometimes as I'm writing these characters, it's a form of therapy, and it'll just sort of flesh out little parts of yourself and things that you don't necessarily think of very often.
And you can kill people you don't like.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. It's a great outlet for anger. But I find the scenes where the woman who's blogging starts getting threats on her blog are, to me, some of the scariest scenes in the book, because I know that occasionally that's happened with me. And it's one of those things where you choose to believe that it's just some nutty person messing with you and that they don't actually mean to act on it. But of course, you never know. And I think of those movie trailers, you know, from the 70s that actually tapped into those latchkey yeah. kid fears of a stranger tapping on the window and going, "Have you checked the children?" You know,
yeah.
those were so scary because the idea that you're sitting and someone's watching you through the window.
He knows you're alone.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's where the girl gets so hysterical.
Right.
She calls the cops
right.
and the cops say, "Oh, the phone
right.
call is coming from inside the house."
Right,
oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
But now that we lock the doors and draw the shades so that nobody's literally watching you through the window, so the virtual equivalent of that, though, is when you're sitting at your desk writing, and in this case, writing something incredibly personal where she's talking about these horrible things that happened to her as a kid, to be putting all of that out there with the best intentions, and she's reading the comments, and, you know, the comments are, "You helped me so much, you know, I'm not alone," you know, and that she reads the comments for validation, really, that she's getting somewhere with people. And then to read a comment that says, "I know who you are and this isn't over," is the equivalent of being watched now, that you're to not know who's reading your words, to not know how much they know about you, is a very frightening thing. So she winds up, her story winds up being entangled with Julia Whitmire.
So you've been a prosecutor and a law professor.
I have.
And you're still a law professor, right?
I am. I teach at Hofstra Law School,
yeah.
criminal law.
Most people don't understand this. They think if somebody makes a threat with words, that's actionable by police. Would you please clear that up?
You know, I left the DA's office here in Portland kind of just as technology and what was already a known phenomenon of stalking started to meet each other. And I worked in the domestic violence unit, and some of the most frustrating conversations to have with victims, and I do see them truly as victims, is explaining how little can be done. That people can email whomever they want and say pretty much whatever they want. And until something bad happens, there's not a lot police can do. And simply just, it's the resources, one, first of all, to even find out who's sending this stuff. It's very easy for people to cloak themselves in anonymity on the internet, but then there's no point in putting the resources to it, because even if you could prove who did it, there really is nothing you can do. And it happens all the time. You know, I have, there's a website called ratemyprofessors.com, which is every professor's nemesis, because your students can just go on there and just write.
And they can say anything they want,
anything
even if it's
they
not
want.
True.
It doesn't have to be true. It doesn't have to be about anything legitimate. They can go in there and talk about your ugly shoes if they want to. And it can be very brutal to read. But a colleague of mine had a student who was, I think, mentally unstable, and would go on there, and it was very clear to us that it was the same person writing it, but they'd go under, they'd create different identities and write horribly untrue things about her that can be very damaging to her academic career, but then also started to say, you know, her one of these days her body will show up in the East River. And, you know, she's got to still go to class, and she thinks the person who wrote that about her is sitting in the class, and there really was nothing that could be done. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, and particularly when it's happening to you, you think there must be something that can be done, but it's so common, and law enforcement is pretty powerless to do anything about it.
Not much comfort of the fact that the East River isn't as polluted as it used
to
be.
No, probably not.
Probably not. I'd like everybody to know that I'm speaking with Alifair Burke. The title of her latest book is Never Tell, published by Harper. And I used to live in Portland. Now you live in New York. When I was reading this book, I guess I've read most of your books. I probably missed one or two, to my eternal shame. But this this movie, this book has enough plot for two other books. A lot of mystery writers love to get involved, convoluted, Baroque plots that eventually wind up fooling everybody. Red herrings are dragged across people's paths. And then at the end, you think you know something, and then on the next to last page, something happens. Now, what I want to know is, how do you come up with this stuff? Do you actually plot out a book? Are you one of those people who does a line of action in a book and has intersecting things? How do you do it?
No, I don't outline, and I've tried to do it because I've been told by some very experienced writers that I could make my life a lot easier if I would just spend, you know, 6 months of the year outlining, so that, and then have a list of, you know, 50 chapters or 50 scenes, and then, you know, every day write one, and then I would be done. It sounds so easy. And I've tried it, and it doesn't work for me. And I think the reason why is I have to know the characters sometimes before I even know what the book's about, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have an idea of what a case is about. I'll have an idea of, okay, so there's going to be a girl and she'll die, and it'll be unclear if someone killed her, if she did it to herself. But until I really started writing the book and getting to know Julia's family and getting to know that Langston family and getting to know Casey, I didn't really know what the book was more deeply about. And sometimes I discover that as I go, and then I go back and I have to change some things and I'll rewrite. And it's kind of a maddening way to write a book. But at least for me, I feel like when I've done that, the book is better for it, because I don't have a lot of red herrings. I write scenes, and sometimes I don't even know how they come together. And the challenge for me is to find out how they do come together and then make that work. And every once in a while, things really will surprise me. In my last book, Long Gone, somebody died whom I didn't plan to die. And after I had written it, I actually kind of got sad. And I'm like, I think this person would die. Like, I think that's the only way it really makes sense. And in this book, one of the surprises was Casey Hines, the homeless teenager that Julia and Ramona befriend at Washington Square Park, became a much bigger part of the book than I ever planned for him to be. And it really was, just because I look at it as, when I write a book over the course of a year, I pretty much get to know these people who exist, I suppose, only in my head, but it feels like they really do exist to me. And I let them sort of drive the story. And I was surprised that Casey kind of kept coming up in surprising ways.
Was Jimmy Grisco always a part of the book?
Not on the page. He always existed in the book, and I decided to actually have scenes from his perspective after I had actually written the first draft, that I found that it helped the pacing of the book to know that that person existed, even if you don't know necessarily who he is or how he fits in, to actually see that happening in Buffalo, New York, and have him thinking about the past, a past that intersects with these two families, I think improved the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's kind of a wild card running through the book, and you never quite know what's up with this guy, you know, until the very end. I mean, it's one of the things that's revealed at the very end of the book. Interesting, two things that I found personally interesting that nobody else is going to care about it but me, but I love the fact that you give a shout out to the Ramones and CBGBs, my favorite band from the 70s.
Awesome.
Yeah, they really were the best, weren't they? And also Buffalo. I went to school in Buffalo, and poor Buffalo, it just never seems to get any better, does it?
No, I don't know if you know this. I lived there
for how long?
For 2 years. I followed a boy that I met in Portland who went to Reed College with me, did his medical residency, which... it's the closest thing there is to being shipped off by the military without actually being in the military. You just get matched and off you go. And so I was certain he would get matched in Portland and I would never have to leave this place. And he got matched in Buffalo, so I followed him there. And Buffalo and the boy are both long gone from my life. But, you know, Buffalo, the people there were very kind people. And the city itself has... the potential to be, it was a second largest city, the second wealthiest city.
It was a great city.
It was the turn of the century.
A depot on the Erie Canal.
Yeah.
It had grain mills, it had steel mills, Lockport and Gasport of all these steel mills.
Right.
It was a Rust Belt town.
In terms of its topography, I mean, it really has the ability to be a beautiful city.
Of course, the weather is totally horrible.
Horribly mismanaged. Mm-hmm. The government there, from what I could tell, was... no one wants to make any bold decisions. It's cronyism. And
it's always been that way.
It's always been that, from what I can tell. And it was an odd town. I don't mean to sound like I'm dissing it, as they say. But
I have no problem with
that. They just made mistake after mistake. And to move to a city like that after being in one like Portland, which, you know, you can pick at it if you want, but is a pretty well-managed city compared to most American cities, was so frustrating to see the lessons, you know, of things I had learned about city management and crime control and all those things from Portland. And then you go to Buffalo and they're 40 years behind. They have one of the best universities in New York located there. They move it from the center of town. They move it out to the suburbs.
UB is in where? SUNY Buffalo?
SUNY Buffalo, the main campus has just died out and they moved everything up to the suburbs.
Wow.
And then they wonder why their city's not thriving. So
how are you going to get bocce pizza?
Bocce pizza is one of the few things I miss about Buffalo.
Yeah, me too.
That is a killer
right
pizza.
Right across the street from campus, the reason this book has a lot of personal and corporate corruption in it, which is somehow, you know, dovetailed into the main plot. But Buffalo, to me, I mean, I came from New York City, which is not exactly the good government capital of the universe, right? And I get to Buffalo, and there's two mayors. There's a mayor who gets elected, usually because his predecessor has been caught in a scandal. Then he's in for a term or two. Then he gets caught in a scandal. Then the other guy comes back. These two guys switched the mayoralty all the time I was there.
Yeah.
It was extremely funny. And the people were always going to jail and always getting indicted. And it was always the main aide or one of the people on the city council. It was the most unbelievable thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Corporate corruption in your book. There are lawyers doing things that lawyers shouldn't do. There are shrinks doing things that shrinks shouldn't do. And they're all doing it for dirty money. Yeah. Tell us a little about it. I don't want you to give away too much. What can you tell us?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want the... not every rich person in the book's a bad guy. But I do think that the temptations that are there now for professions to become tainted are pretty overwhelming. And I kind of get it, right? So if you're a doctor and you're trying not to be the one who overprescribes and somebody, some rich kid, wants Adderall during finals week to help them concentrate, and you don't write that prescription, they're just going to find another doctor. Meanwhile, you know, they're supposed to, they have to do a certain number of office hours a day or they can't pay their overhead, and insurance is docking them in terms of how much they, an HMO is willing to cover. And so I kind of get it that the easiest thing for them to do is get their prescription pad out. But I think it's done a tremendous amount of damage, I think, to particularly that young generation where so many of them are medicated. And I have, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but I mean, I know I see kids at the law school. They're not even kids. They're young adults. But some of them legitimately need the stuff and some of them don't. And some of them go get prescriptions that they don't really need and then sell it to their friends. And are the double standard of how we think about drug dealing and we think about addiction. You know, if you use one kind of drug, you go to prison. You use another kind of drug, it's kind of in vogue to have these prescription drugs laying around everywhere, and you just go to rehab if something bad happens. And I find that perplexing, I guess.
depressing, actually. Yeah. Not that I want Xanax or anything like that. But yeah, of all the sleazy characters in this book, and there are some, there, and at all levels, you've been extremely fair in dishing out the sleaziness to street kids, lawyers, you know, the cops. You know, there's always that PI. Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit about him.
Yeah.
But what was that kid's name? The kid who went to the school and talked to Ellie and JJ. A little snot nose, Marcus. Marcus Graves,
yes.
Is that his name?
Graves.
I actually flagged that chapter and reread it because this kid was so awful. Tell us about that chapter.
It's funny, my editor wanted to cut that chapter.
No.
I know. You know, it's one of these kids, you know, I don't want to talk bad about people I don't even know, but I saw, where was it? Some magazine I was flipping through on the plane, and the two sons of the guy who's the publisher for Interview Magazine, their mother is Stephanie Seymour, I think, the supermodel. These two beautiful kids, and I'm sure they're very smart kids, but they're already showing them like at these magazine premieres. They're already starting to work at the magazine. They show them at all these clubs with bottle service and all of these celebrities standing next to models, standing next to rap stars. And I don't care how good a kid's head is. To be 16 running around that world, I don't know how you deal with anything after that, right? Nothing else will be special when you already have that kind of life at 16. So Marcus Graves is already expected by his dad to be this little mini entrepreneur. You know, he talks about how he's interested in bars and entertainment and things and in the restaurant business. And his dad thinks that's terribly beneath him. And one of my favorite lines, I say it as if I didn't write it, I'll pat myself on the back because it doesn't even make any sense, but it makes total sense to me that a guy like Marcus Graves' father would say this to him. He says that the restaurant business is for gays and immigrants.
Oh, you know, I read that and I said, I know people like him. Yes.
Exactly.
Not well.
So he's already being, instead he's, you know, put together with a hotel company that's a little classier, I guess, than a mere restaurant. But the disdain that he has for regular people kind of oozes off the page that when he tells Ellie, we're not like kids, that, you know, the fact that she even uses the word kids or uses the word dating, you know, he finds so parochial and says, you know, we're not like these kids that, you know, we're not the children of bookkeepers and cops, you know, that's they're expected to be great. And because of that, that they're messed up. He basically says, like, Julie and I were messed up. Deal with it. Yeah,
there's a deep abiding cynicism in this kid that usually takes a lifetime to acquire. And he's, what, 17 years old? And he's like that. I was horrified until I realized that, you know, that old colloquy between Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, where Fitzgerald allegedly said, you know, Ernest, the very rich are different from you and me. And Hemingway said, yeah, they have more money. And it occurs to me that Hemingway did not understand a word that Fitzgerald was saying.
Yeah.
They are different from you and me. They expect things that you and I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
It's a given in their lives. And they behave the same way. It's privilege. Everything is privilege.
Well, and I'm lucky to have seen it, because growing up in Kansas or even living here, you know, I had to now kind of see that and live next to it. It's very fertile ground for my writing. And, you know, and I one of the things I like about this book is it's not just wealthy people. It's some of my favorite scenes are ones where Casey, very much on the outside of that world, is looking in. And on the one hand, obviously he's envious, you know, to even have a roof over his head would be a wonderful thing, let alone the kind of roof these people have. But even he, in some sense, knows that Julia in particular was broken, that from even his disadvantaged viewpoint, he's able to see that there's something in her that's very dark.
Yeah, there's also the shelter promises, which is called a halfway house, but it's more than that. And the reason it's more than that is because of the woman that runs it, who has such compassion for the kids in there. I really liked her. I really liked her for the fact that she loved the kids. I really liked her for the fact that she had a lot of integrity about her job. But I also really liked the way she protected them, even from the police. And I thought that character, I thought, was if there were more of her around, then the world would be a better
place. It's so funny that you, I think you're the first person I've talked to about the book that's really honed in on promises and the woman who creates this shelter specifically for kids. I don't think I would have been able to create, you know, the fictional promises if I hadn't lived in Portland, right? So when I was at the DA's office, and I was one of the neighborhood-based district attorneys where you actually worked in the community kind of doing prevention things, that I met, you know, people in social services in Portland, and that commitment that they have to protecting people really is a special thing. And you do still see it in Portland.
And it, like cops, they're overworked and underpaid for the job that they do. And sometimes things slip through the cracks.
Right.
Up until almost the very end, Ellie just hangs on to the idea that this kid must have killed herself. She had such a rough life. Everything was so dark. She had things happening to her that most adults couldn't handle. This kid really, really must have killed herself. And her partner, JJ, says, "Hey, what is with you? You know, you're presupposing. What you're doing is you've already formed an idea about what this case is, and now you're trying to back it up by finding evidence for that. What happened to you?" That's my question to you. What happened to her? What is it? Simply her own dark past that's warping her usual sense?
Yeah, so that's one part of the book where, I mean, anybody who's never read the Ellie Hatcher series can pick up the book and read it. But I think that's one aspect of the book that, for people who have read the previous novels, will be in a position to really understand Ellie's frustration, because one of the things that's happened over the course of the series is when we first meet Ellie, she still very much believes that her father did not commit suicide. And over the course of the book, she's actually started to now think that he did. And the fact that she spent 20 years of her life, you know, her entire childhood and her young adulthood, fighting to prove that her father was murdered, he didn't commit suicide, and her mother's trained her to believe that. And she kind of feels duped, that she was gullible, that she was a sucker. And so I think when she sees the Whitmire family resisting the truth, what Ellie believes is the truth, that Julia killed herself, she's not sympathetic to them at all. You would think maybe she should be sympathetic, that she had been in those shoes. But the reason she's not sympathetic is because in her situation, she had nothing to do with her. She couldn't be blamed for her father's suicide, right? She sees herself as a victim of her father's suicide. Whereas with Julia's parents, she very much blames them. You know, that of course your child killed herself. Look how you treated her.
Technology plays a big part here. Now, we're still relatively new in technology. I guess 20 years ago, this book couldn't have had a lot of the plot points in it that it has. For example, I won't give too much away here, but there's a cell phone picture that turns out to be far more important than it seems to be at the beginning.
Right.
How has, I mean, you've worked with cops, you've been a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. How has the cyber universe, the cloud, whatever you want to call it, how has that changed policing, and how has that changed the way people enforce the law?
Yeah, it's a weird kind of cat and mouse game, because on the one hand, people can use technology in ways that they couldn't in the past to get to people, right, and to find people and to harass people, and I've made pretty good use out of that the last couple of books. It also helps people remain anonymous. They can cloak, they can put IP cloaking software on their computers. On the other hand, if you're not that savvy, technology actually helps police a lot, right? I mean, a very notorious case locally, for example, a cell phone ping to Sovie Island, right, is a big part of what appears to be law enforcement's theory of that case. And without cell phones, that case would look very, very different, right? If it weren't for a stepmother saying I was in this side of town and yet her cell phone is in Sovie Island, that case would look very, very different. If it weren't for her Facebook posts that day, right, that case looks very, very different. So,
is this the Kyron case?
So technology, I think, helps law enforcement a lot. The cell phone technology, the GPS, you know, in the New York area, if you drive through the tunnel with your Easy Pass, you know, they're able to know that. And I've kind of embraced the technology for people who know Sue Grafton's books. The A is for alibi, B is for burglar books. She's chosen to keep that series set where she started it, which was in the early 80s, I believe, where computers are new, there are no cell phones, there is no internet. I've kind of done the opposite, which is take the world as it is. And sometimes it's a big pain in the butt. I've got to explain, like, why can't they just text somebody for help? You know, so how many times can you have the cell phone battery die or the signal go bad? And so you have to deal with the inconveniences of the tale, because the average reader is going to say, oh, they could just go get the camera footage or they could just do this. So that's the downside. Yeah. But the bonus is I can do some things that are pretty clever that I wouldn't have been able to do 20 years ago.
Yeah. When I watched that wonderful series, The Wire, on cable. The burn phone.
Right.
I mean, I never even considered a thing like this. Crooks can just go buy a dozen phones at a convenience store, and they can use them once or twice and then throw them away.
Yes.
And there's no way to trace them.
And thank goodness for it, because I have to resort to those a lot in the books to explain why they can't just trace phone calls.
Burn phones, It's always wonderful to talk to you. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a standalone where the main character, Ron D., is a former prosecutor turned writer. And she is tracking down the local story of something that happens on the subway, and she gets cell phone, speaking of technology, a bystander's cell phone camera picture, and she realizes that she believes that the woman in that picture is a friend of hers who disappeared without a trace a decade earlier. So she tries to find her missing friend and solve an old case that's very personal to her. But it's the first time I've tried to write a book that really takes place in two timelines, the present and the one where not only has her friend disappeared, but her own prosecutorial career is kind of falling apart. So talk about complicated plots. I'm having a hard time juggling all the pieces of it.
I'm sure you do just fine.
Thank you.
We all need good editors. I mean, I
have a fantastic editor.
Yeah. No matter who you are. I mean, you know, there are originally 13 commandments, and, you know, the editor said, oh, you know, these two really are the same thing. You just put them together. This one, you don't need this at all.
I've been very lucky. My editor has been my editor the entire time for, this is the eighth book, I guess, and she's a big champion of my work, but she's incredibly smart. She's Michael Chabon's editor. She edits some really great people and kind of keeps me around too.
So. You're a lucky person.
Yes.
I would like to tell people that I've been speaking with Alafair Burke, first name spelled Alafair. Title of the book is Never Tell, published by Harper. I expect to see you back for your next book.
Definitely. Anytime. I love being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.